Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Crane coming at us live from the Saxe Coburg Gotha Kingdom. Ian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Benny, how you doing?
Well, I think it's, I'm a little angry. And, you know what, Ian? I think a lot of people are. Like, just this last week or two. Have you noticed? Everybody's just kind of real aggro in some kind of way. Allegedly, and I think you've talked about this during some of your presentations that I've filmed, the sun can really, really affect your mood. And apparently there's been a couple of big sunspot bursts or something like that coming off, which is driving everybody just a little bit nuts, I think.
Well, quite possibly. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, we're impacted by the solar activity, just like the police know very well that on a full moon, they're always a lot more active than they are during the rest of the month.
Yeah, that's where the term lunatic comes from.
Exactly, exactly. And, I mean, when you look at what's happening around the globe right now, I mean, we may not see it, you know, in the sort of microcosm of our hometown, but if you look around the world and you look at, you know, how people are reacting in Brazil, in Turkey, in Egypt, you know, literally taking to the streets in there, hundreds of thousands to, you know, protest at the way they're being treated by their respective governments. I mean, this is going to continue. It's only going to grow. I mean, in the UK, I mean, you know, one of the phrases that really grates on me, Vinny, and it came into the sort of corporate speak probably about 20 years ago, and that's human resources. Because, you know, that's exactly how the global corporatists see humanity. I mean, as a commodity to be used, abused, and then just spat out, you know, when they no longer are serving the need.
When people say to me the word human resources, I envision a scene from Monty Python where they had a whole bunch of people crammed into a meat grinder.
Well, that's really about it. You know, I don't know whether you have it in New Zealand, but, you know, one of the things that has emerged over in the UK as the economy has, you know, literally gone into the proverbial toilet. So not only do we have masses of youth unemployment, I mean, not as bad in the UK as it is in Spain and Italy and Ireland, although in Ireland, usually 500,000 young people have left Ireland in the last 5 years. I mean, it's a form of depopulation. But you know, the Irish are obviously going over to New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and some even sort of finding some employment here in the UK. But you know, what we've got in the UK now is 0 hours contracts, which means that basically a company says, yeah, we'd like to take you on, but we're not going to guarantee you any work or any salary. We will only pay you when we call you to come in and work. And by the way, we expect you to be at our beck and call. So consequently, you know, in some cases, some of the more able of these young people, you know, they're obviously getting 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 0-hours contracts. And then they find themselves in a situation of conflict because each of these employers expect them to jump when they say jump. And, you know, despite the fact there's absolutely, you know, no loyalty whatsoever from the company, they are literally a human resource. And it's 21st century slave labor.
Well, when you don't have any rights, you don't have any, what's it called, security in your life?
You've got no benefits. No, there's nothing. I mean, no pension accrual. You know, no private health care, no holiday pay. I mean, absolutely nothing. I mean, it's in my opinion, I mean, this is, you know, the way in which obviously we can expect to see it continue to unfold. And, you know, in the UK as well, you know, benefits are being cut, even though there's no work. So, you know, it's one thing to cut benefits if there is work available. But, you know, we have more jobs in the UK now paying minimum wage than at any time since records started being taken. And, you know, a big part of this is the immigration. And of course, Peter Sutherland, who is a very senior statesman, I mean, he's Irish by an accident of birth, but, I mean, he's a global corporatist. I mean, he's the guy who was absolutely responsible for bringing down the Irish economy.
Along with the current Prime Minister of New Zealand.
The then Prime Minister. What, Keyes? John Keyes?
Yeah, John Key, when he was working for Merrill Lynch, Ireland passed a whole bunch of laws. They gave sweetheart tax breaks to those who were doing derivatives trading if they moved their back offices into Ireland. So that's what John Key did. Working for Merrill Lynch, he moved his back offices here, hollowed out the Irish economy with massive amounts of derivative debt.
But then she imploded. The line was cracking up a bit there.
Yeah, then the Irish economy imploded.
It was totally outrageous. And but, I mean, this guy, Sutherland, actually conducted participated in an interview with the BBC, ironically, on Midsummer's Day 2012. So it was 21st of June 2012, which is why the date absolutely sticks in my mind. But in that interview, he stated that the global...
Having some real bad connectivity problems there, Ian. What did he state again? Ian, are you there? Uh-oh. That's not good. Let's see if we can get you maybe on the... I think I've got a little bit of Skype credit left, or Ian can call in. Uh-oh. This is not good. Not good. Okay, well... We've got you back. I can hear you now. You really got to drop that phone number into the caller line there. I've got to figure out how to do this. Yeah, it's a real bugger when we don't have the American Freedom Radio caller lineup. We really need to get that sorted as soon as humanly possible. Worst case scenario, if you're not able to call US numbers from your mobile AN.
No. But I can call from my Skype.
You can call the number from your Skype. Well, the problem is we're trying to correct the technical issue of the Skype, and that's because of your connectivity, so that wouldn't work either. We really do need to actually connect you up on your cell phone. So if you pop it in here, I may, just may, be able to bring you into the Skype call using my Skype credit, because the studio is out of Skype credit at the moment. So just quickly type that cell phone number to me in the chat here, mate, and I'll see if I can connect you on that. Well, who knows? Maybe everything will work out swimmingly with the Skype connection for the rest of the thing, but just in case, you know.
Yeah, just in case. Okay, I've sent you the mobile number. So did you catch what I was saying about Peter Sutherland and actually telling the BBC that it was the globalist policy to destroy national homogeneity by ramping up immigration, to effectively deliberately break down the culture of the nation state?
He said that on BBC.
Yep, absolutely. If you, I mean, if you go into any search engine and you Google Peter Sutherland, BBC, national homogeneity, or something like that, you'll find the report of that interview he gave with the BBC. And I mean, you know, this is, you know, Vinny, this is how they work. They work on the basis of, they tell us, they have to tell us what they're doing. They don't necessarily blast it all over the front pages, but they'll slip it in, like Peter Sutherland did in that interview, so that it's out there. And then when there's no reaction, of course, they take that as their social license to pursue with that particular policy.
It's because people don't even watch or listen or actively participate anymore in the way their country is being run. And so naturally, it gets run into the ground.
Well, that's true. Although I have to say, Vinny, that something very, very significant occurred on August 29th in the UK. And the irony is, the great tragedy is, that the vast majority of people, even though it's, almost exactly, I guess, 9 weeks after that, most people have forgotten what occurred on that day. And that day, at some point in the future, that day will be recognized by historians as absolutely catalytic in terms of everything that unfolds from this point. And you have no idea what I'm talking about, do you?
No.
I wouldn't expect you to, because obviously you're the other side of the world. But what happened on August the 29th was that the British Parliament was recalled to vote on whether or not the Parliament would support David Cameron in his call to get sanction to launch a cruise missile attack on the civilian population of Syria, supposedly in retaliation for Assad, President Assad of Syria, unleashing chemical weapons on the rebels or on the civilian population. And despite the fact there was absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever in the public domain, and there's still no evidence to this day that Assad was responsible. In fact, it actually looks as though it was the rebels who had been given the chemical weapons by Saudi Arabia, but unfortunately they hadn't been given the handling instructions, and so there was a very unfortunate accident in which the sarin was released, killing anything between 500 and 1,500 civilians. Well, David Cameron was effectively instructed by the global corporatists to call Parliament to get a sanction to launch a retaliation on Assad, which would have probably been the end of Assad's regime in Syria. But for the first time in 231 years, the British Prime Minister did not get his way when he asked for Parliament to support his call. And what happened was basically the British public actually got engaged in the political process for probably the first time in a long, long, long time. You know, people had, obviously, the memory of Tony Blair's lies and deceit surrounding the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I mean, everyone knows that Tony Blair was lying when he stated in Parliament that Iraq had the capacity to launch a nuclear attack on Britain, you know, with just 45 minutes' notice.
And didn't he get re-elected after that?
He did, incredibly, although... that's a whole other issue about the election system. I absolutely do not believe that Tony Blair got a majority in his constituency in the 2005 election. I just do not believe it. I believe that, you know, the figures were deliberately manipulated because obviously they couldn't have a sitting prime minister defeated in his own constituency. But I have very, very severe doubts about the integrity of that particular ballot. But anyway, so he did get re-elected is the answer, and he stayed in office until he handed over to Gordon Brown a few years later. But everyone knew that that Blair was lying, and of course Britain was dragged into yet another illegal war because we were already involved in the Afghanistan mess. So the British people had no stomach for getting involved in another conflict, and particularly another conflict where there was absolutely no evidence in the public domain to support the claim that Assad had unleashed these weapons. So what happened here was people got on the phone, they phoned their MPs, they phoned the MPs' offices in their constituency, they phoned their researchers in Westminster. They emailed, some even wrote letters, would you believe? And that old-fashioned way of communicating. And enough Conservative MPs realized that if they were going to genuinely uphold the fiduciary trust, which is ostensibly the responsibility that they have when they're elected, i.e. they are elected to represent the electorate, not to represent the party, and enough of them, in fact, 32 Conservative MPs, for whatever reason, but they didn't make it to Parliament that day. You know, the car broke down, trains broke down, whatever excuse, because they didn't have the courage to actually vote against the party whip, so they just didn't show up. But there were 30 Tory MPs who voted against David Cameron. Now, this is very, very brave of these 30, and I'm sure they're paying the price today. But the ultimate result of that ballot, Vinny, is very, very significant, because the ultimate result was 285.
We'll pick this up after the break, actually, and just hold that thought. Don't you go anywhere, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one like me. Yeah. 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 Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader. It's been a long time coming, yo. But I'm here now. So what you wanna do? How many dudes you really know can flow like this, like this, like this? Let's do it. How many dudes you know move like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, if any, not many, if any. How many dudes you know got skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. Check, check to the mic, check. 1, 2 from a crew coming through. Are you hype yet? Nowadays, everybody wanna talk, but we got some no scribe. Ain't got nothing when I'm up in the live. It came from when you feeling the vibe. You know, scribe is kicking me high. Level with the double bass. Vibrate, shoot the place, and you're ready to break. Y'all hear the man move like an RS. Super rule with the crew from a quick.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Ian R. Crane. Now, Ian, I know you talk about the world's problems. I know you talk about fracking and how it's very dangerous for humanity. I know you talk about the these new Labour kind of reforms in England that's going to make people have a very hard time indeed. But apparently you yourself are actually on hard times. And I find that in the truth community, we're so busy trying to help other people who can't help themselves that we forget to ask for help ourselves.
Yeah, someone's obviously had a word in your ear.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's the price you pay. You know, there are those in the truth community who think that, you know, because we're out there and, you know, we're doing what we do, that we must be raking in buku to bucks. When in reality, of course, you know, we're leeching it the whole time. And, I mean, I've been on this campaign trail, if you like, for nearly 12 years now. And, I mean, every year it sort of has been eating into my reserve resources. And this year, you know, with everything that I've been throwing into the fracking issue and raising fracking awareness, I mean, I've done 88 public talks this year around the UK and Ireland, trying to raise awareness of the fracking issue. I spent 29 of the 66 days of the Borkum blockade on the front line at Borkum, you know, basically recording it, videoing it, putting out bulletins about it. And yeah, effectively, I mean, I was subsidizing my activities, you know, myself. And eventually, I guess it sort of catches up. And so now, unfortunately, the pockets are very empty. So, yeah, it resulted in the fact that when I came back from Borkum, my landlord, which is a bank, would you believe, my landlord decided that, you know, it was time for me to move out of my apartment. So, yes, at the end of this month, I'm technically homeless.
Unless you come up with how much?
Oh, well, you know, it's... I mean, it's not just a question of how much. I mean, it's really a question. I've got to try and find a way to, you know, sustain, you know, what I do. And I mean, I appreciate, Vinny, you know, the problem is that, I mean, everybody is finding it, you know, more and more difficult. You know, people are struggling to keep their own, you know, roof over their head and food on the table. But, you know, if we stop doing what we're doing, then there will be no opposition to this globalist agenda. I mean, I have focused on the fracking issue this year because I realize if we don't nail this hydraulic fracturing issue, and I believe that there is a much, much deeper agenda to this global shale gas, coal bed methane, coal seam gas industry, if we don't nail it, then we have a very, very serious problem. I mean, what we're seeing, you know, all around the world is, particularly in the US, in Canada, and in, very much so in southern Queensland. And southern Queensland is a very recent addition to the whole hydraulic fracturing industry. But after just a few years, you know, we're seeing large tracts of land effectively become uninhabitable. You know, the water supply is poisoned, becomes toxic, with a combination of methane migration and also frack fluid migration. We're finding that the soil artificial porosity is being created in the geology, which enables the methane to migrate up through the soil and into the atmosphere. So soil is becoming contaminated, the atmosphere is becoming contaminated. And even, you know, today, would you believe, in the British media, there is the most outrageous bullshit being published that says, well, you know, it's low risk. And, oh, and by the way, there's not too many studies on the long-term effects of living in these kind of environments. Well, the reason there's no studies...
And it's good for global warming. I loved that part. Like, it's good for environmentalism to contaminate the land so that it's unlivable.
Well, exactly. And the reality is, I mean, the reality is that methane... The methane leaching from these wells that are created in unconventional geology, in very tight geology, the methane leach is going to have a far greater impact on the atmosphere than carbon dioxide ever could. You know, I mean, if you wanted to initiate a plan of action to literally terraform, in other words, to change the whole ecology so that it cannot sustain life as we know it, but maybe life as we don't yet know it, then I can't think of a faster way of doing it. So consequently, you know, to come back to your original question, I have moved away from, you know, what I had been doing, which was talking about the longer term unfolding agenda. You know, I was looking at things that were coming down the pipe in 10, 20, 50, 100 or more years. But once the moratorium was lifted on the hydraulic fracturing process in the UK, I realized that if we don't shut this down, if the people don't appreciate the magnitude of the threat, then, you know, everything else almost becomes irrelevant, because within two, three, maybe four generations at the absolute outside, then, you know, the Earth will not be able to sustain life in anything like the form that we know it today. So, yes, there has been a price to pay, and that price has been my personal resources have effectively depleted to the point of being in negativity.
Okay. Well, I see the solution to this problem. There's all of a sudden there are immediate needs. So let's say it's you're £1,000 behind on rent. You need that just to get your head back above water, right?
But yeah, on top of that, right.
But on top of that, £1,000, you also need a regular contributions from people. Now, on the website, ladies and gentlemen, ianrcrane.com, ianrcrane.com, on the top right, there's a little thingy where you can actually change the currency. So it's regularly set to pounds sterling, but it can be changed to Australian dollars, euros, New Zealand, that kind of thing. And on the left, you can donate through PayPal, just down on the left there. And what I'd also recommend is using the option that's just below that, where it actually allows you to make a regular donation through PayPal for a number of months. So if we could get, let's say, I don't know, how much is... you don't want to like reveal how much exactly rent is a month, but basically you need as much people contributing, just a little bit, you know, £5 a month for like 6 months or something.
Well, yeah, Vinny, you know, you and I know that everyone who is doing what we do, who has effectively taken the decision to sort of focus all of our efforts on this, you know, we all live extremely frugal lifestyles. Mm. And any spare resources that we have, you know, literally go into the campaigning. I mean, I have driven, I'm on my second car this year because my van, my trusty van, which I'd had for 5 years, finally died on me. But, you know, the car that I've had for just 5 months now, and I have driven just under 20,000 miles, so that's 32,000 kilometers in 5 months, literally in holding, you know, public events and trying to raise awareness of this. And let me say, you know, if people would prefer to contribute or donate directly to the fracking awareness campaign, then, you know, they can go into the other fund, which is on frackingnightmare.com. And this is frackingnightmare.com is the website that's been set up to effectively support the weekly online show that I have going out from a UK online channel, UK Column, that goes out on Monday nights. The first edition was last Monday. It's called Fracking Nightmare. So the first edition is up on YouTube. So anyone going to frackingnightmare.com, they can watch the first episode. That's going to be a weekly show. In fact, on Monday, when it goes out on Monday, I have Brian Monk from Australia, who'll be talking about his experience of living above the Southern Queensland gas fields. And, you know, we'll be hearing Brian explain the lies and the deceit and the obfuscation and all the health issues that he has had to endure, you know, from living over the gas fields. And what I'm going to be doing is building that show so that we're literally not just going to be addressing the UK. We will be talking about the UK, obviously, because the UK agenda is unfolding at a phenomenal rate of knots. But we're going to be bringing in people from the US, from Canada, from Australia, or from anywhere around the world that has been impacted by this abomination. So if people want to support what I'm trying to do in raising awareness on the global fracking issue, then go to www.frackingnightmare.com, and you'll see exactly the same type of donation boxes that you just described that are on my website. But they go into the specific fracking awareness campaign fund.
It does need to be done, and I have no doubt that the people will give generously to you, Ian, because I've found I don't necessarily believe in karma, but I believe in the goodness of people. And if you're a good person who does good things for other people, other good people who take personal responsibility for rewarding you and honouring the contributions that you make, give of themselves back to you. It ain't karma. I think it's a choice. Or at least that's my that's been my perspective of it, because I've met so many good people in this movement who've contributed massively just to keep me on the air. And it's about taking personal responsibility to ensure those things that you like, the things that you consume, the things that you actually truly value, take responsibility and support them. So please, ladies and gentlemen, please, I implore you, go to either ianrcrane.com or frackingnightmare.com, whichever tickles your pickle, and make a wee donation, you know, perhaps even a massive donation. A couple of £500 donations, I'm sure, would go very well down indeed. Because if Ian's travelling all over the UK and he's travelling 20, what was it you said, like 20,000 miles in just 5 months or whatever, it must be a killer with the gas, mate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I've got a vehicle that, you know, gives me pretty good mileage. But, of course, you know, I mean, it still works out at about £200 for every 1,000 miles. So, yeah, it all mounts up. But, yeah, and Vinny, I mean, I know that, you know, those of us who are out there on a full-time basis, I mean, there are many, many people who would love to be doing, you know, what we do. But, you know, they've got responsibility. They've got family responsibilities. They've got a mortgage. You know, and consequently, obviously, they have to keep on doing what they're doing. You know, what we have tended to do, and I mean, I think this is the case with everybody I've met who is doing this in terms of trying to raise awareness on these subjects on a full-time basis. I mean, everybody is literally living hand-to-mouth. I mean, it's a very sort of frugal existence because, you know, we are so committed. I mean, we're working pretty much 24/7 in trying to make sure that our information is up to date, that our information is accurate, that we're able to debate, you know, with the opposition. I mean, you know, on the show, if people watch the recording from last week's Fracking Nightmare show, you know, they'll see that I put out the challenge. I said, I am ready to debate with any government minister, with anybody in the industry, because I know that the only way in which they can argue their case is basically to ignore all of the negatives. So, you know, obviously we've got to have, you know, a phenomenal depth and breadth of knowledge. I mean, it just so happens, of course, that I did spend, you know, nearly 20 years in the oilfield services industry. I've been out of that industry for 15 years, but, you know, nonetheless, that experience, it's certainly very valuable in terms of giving me the depth and breadth of understanding so that I can you know, talk authoritatively on the subject. And this is how we have to do it, but we're operating literally on loose change when the government and the industries, of course, have very, very deep pockets. You know, they have enormous PR budgets. And, you know, I mean, when I was doing the tour, every time I got material printed, of course, it was, you know, flying off the tables faster than I could keep up with it. And of course, you know, even though we have, you know, printers that help us out by literally printing at cost, nonetheless, there is still a cost.
It is a cost, ladies and gentlemen, and I believe it's very much like a military campaign, like back in World War II. In order to support the troops on the front lines, you would buy war bonds, right? Other than the fact that all the money actually really eventually went to the bankers. But in this case, you are supporting the war effort against these frackers, literally. We'll be right back. Yeah. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of madness and chaos, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go freaking nuts. Now, also, another thing that I find funny, you're familiar with the comedy style called schadenfreude, you know, to laugh at somebody who stumbles so badly. I love laughing at when the globalists put their foot in their mouth or something like that. It's real funny. Is there any better? But it doesn't happen that often. Not often enough, anyway. Any amusing likeness of that kind happening in the UK? Some kind of politician really, really saying something he shouldn't have?
Oh, absolutely, Vinny. I mean, we had it about 6-8 weeks ago now. I lost track of time. But, you know, when the Balkan blockade was going on, and by the way, the Balkan blockade was incredibly successful because we still have not had any wells fracked in the UK since the wells were fracked in the northwest of England in 2011. And the moratorium was put on because it was pretty evident that the seismic activity was related to the fracking. So the moratorium was put in place for 18 months, and then the moratorium was lifted by, we'll go back to perhaps who was involved a bit later, but I mean, it's corruption through and through at the heart of government. But anyway, when the Balkan blockade was underway, and of course there were literally hundreds of people there for the whole time, but on, you know, two or three weekends through the blockade, there were literally thousands of people there. And in Parliament, Lord Howell, who probably should be named Lord Howler, but Lord Howell, who happens to be the father-in-law of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, but because of all the activity in the southeast of England, i.e., you know, this is the commuter belt, He stood up in the House of Lords and said, well, you know, actually, we should probably focus the fracking in the desolate northeast. Well, that, of course, pissed off all the people who live in the not-so-desolate northeast of England. So when there was a reaction in the media because of his comment that day, he then, the following day, said, well, actually, I didn't mean the desolate northeast, I meant the desolate northwest. So now he's pissed off another tranche of people who live in the northwest of England, and then George Osborne came out, his son-in-law, and tried to sort of pour oil on the troubled waters, as it were, by saying, well, actually, you know what, we just need to frack the whole country. So, literally, you know, within those 3 days, it had the effect of raising awareness at a very significant rate. I mean, more than we could have done, you know, with our activity, because obviously this was reported in the media. You know, the gaff was sort of prime core for a lot of editorial. So yeah, I mean, it was brilliant. And you know, these guys will shoot themselves in the foot. I mean, there is nothing, and I mean nothing, positive about this process. I mean, the great tragedy is that, of course, the vast majority, maybe even all of the people who are listening to us this evening, are nodding their head in agreement, because they know very, very well that this process of hydraulic fracturing for shale gas, for coal bed methane, or coal seam gas — coal bed methane, coal seam gas, by the way, the same thing, it's just that we call them by different names either side the globe. But, you know, everybody knows that this is a technology that doesn't work in the way that the industry claims. It's, you know, it's a technology getting the gases or freeing the gases out of the tight geology, but it causes such devastation in the geology that it ultimately has resulted in the contamination of water, soil, and air, you know, everywhere that it's been unleashed. Now, you know, that's not to say that every single well has resulted in contamination. I'm not suggesting that. But the reality is that because you have to drill so many wells in such a small area, just on the sheer statistical basis, some of those wells are going to fail. I mean, even my former company, Schlumberger, acknowledges that 5% of wells fail almost immediately, i.e. the integrity of the well is compromised because the cement holding the casing in place, you know, is not bonding as it should. But over the course of the life of the well, you know, pretty much every well will fail. And when a well fails, it means that it creates a pathway for the gases to migrate into higher geology, ultimately into the water table, and then ultimately out into the atmosphere. And everybody listening to tonight probably knows that. But it's still not enough of us. And our challenge, of course, our challenge has to be creative, to use whatever initiative we can encourage people to do, you know, to raise awareness of this. And, you know, one of the lessons that we have definitely learned in the UK from Australia, is that in Australia, tragically, I mean, if we look at southern Queensland, they've literally had thousands of wells drilled there over a relatively short time period, about 5 years. But, of course, the population density of Queensland is 1/100th of that of the UK. So, unfortunately, they were really behind the eight ball because they didn't have the critical mass of people to be able to, block an industry, or a government and an industry that was so determined to effectively destroy that part of the country.
It's a shame when you don't have that critical. It's a shame when you don't have that critical mass of people. You've only just got a mass of people who are critical.
Yeah, I mean, it was a mass of people that were critical. I mean, there was people protesting. There were people trying to block them, but you know, the industry and the government were using tremendous subterfuge to make them ineffectual.
Now, you also made a point there, which I also think bears reiterating, is that we don't have enough people in order to get this issue out there. I think we actually do have enough people, because what you said in the very next sentence is people being active, all right? We've got enough people who know about it, but it's once people activate, that's when they become a hell of a lot more powerful than just one person who knows what's going on and sits by and does nothing.
Well, with this issue, I must confess that, Vinny, this issue, this particular issue, I think when people fully comprehend the magnitude of the impact of this process, i.e. that it is literally destroying the fresh water supply on the planet, then once they fully understand that, because their initial reaction, of course, is to go, oh, that's just an exaggeration. That's just a conspiracy, you know, because that's their reaction, because people want to believe, they desperately want to believe that their government would never do that to them, or that people in industry would never do that because they're going to have to drink the same water themselves. They're not. What these people, what unfortunately people don't fully appreciate is that this is part of a much, much deeper agenda, and this is going to accelerate the process of planetary culling in a way that very few can really grasp right now. You know, Peter Brabeck, the chief executive of Nestle, recorded an interview in 2005, and in that interview, he made it very clear that, in his opinion, access to fresh water should not be regarded as a human right. You know, what he was saying was that if you want to basically have access to fresh water, you've got to be a corporate slave. You've got to be on the corporate payroll. And he actually, after the cameras were turned off, but the audio recordings were still going, he actually went on to say that he actually believed it to be the same with air. And I know it sounds outrageous, but you know, 10 years ago, if you'd have said to anybody in Southern Ireland that they would have to pay for their water, they would have laughed at you, because embedded in the Irish psyche was the belief that access to fresh water was not only a human right, but your government, you know, took responsibility for ensuring that the people of the nation had free access to fresh water, the very basics of life. Today, the Irish people are paying for their water, and they're paying, you know, an outrageous sum of money for that water, because more and more of the water companies are being sold off to foreign utility companies.
Now, a lot of people have come to me, Ian, and they've talked about particular pieces of legislation that are about to be implemented that they say, oh, that's so insane, it'll never pass. And I say to them, well, actually, it's because it sounds so insane that it will pass, because everybody will think, oh, that's just too crazy, that's not even worth resisting, because obviously the MPs wouldn't be that crazy or stupid.
But you know, and you're right. I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, you know, a lot of people first came to know of my work when 6 and 7 years ago, I was talking about a thing called Codex Alimentarius. Now, I wasn't the first one to be talking about it by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, the guy, I think, deserves the credit for first fully appreciating the magnitude of Codex Alimentarius is a guy called John Hamill, who's based in Seattle in the States. And he was starting to talk about this certainly in the 90s. I mean, I didn't latch on to it until about 2005, when I was looking at the unfolding agenda, the globalist agenda, and I realized that Codex Alimentarius was absolutely at the core of what it was they were trying to do. So I recorded a presentation. It's been watched, I mean, in its various forms by sort of well over 100,000 people or so, which still isn't very many, of course, but in the past 6 years. And in that presentation, I was explaining that there was an agenda to eradicate all natural health products and to abolish all natural farming.
And naturally, everybody says, "What? Hold on a second, you're going to outlaw all natural health products and all farming? Oh, that just sounds so crazy. These people will never pass it." Then boom, they frickin' pass it.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. On May the 1st of this year, it became EU law that all natural health products, unless they had been specifically approved in the past 2 years, are now illegal in the European Union.
Yeah, absolutely. I can just imagine somebody being put in handcuffs or something like that. Oh, what have we got here then, eh? Trying to smuggle some vitamin C tablets. You're nicked, me old son.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm not joking, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.